Welcome to the Diplomats podcast on Asian geopolitics. I'm your host and diplomat editor, Ankit Panda, and joining me today are my colleagues, Prashant Parameshwaran, our editor focused on Southeast Asia, and Shannon Tiezi, our editor focused on China. Thanks a lot for joining me.
Yep, thanks.
Yeah.
Always a pleasure. And what we're going to do today on this podcast is something that should be of interest to most of our listeners. What we're going to do is offer an update of all of the disputes in the South China Sea. As diplomat readers are aware, the South China Sea is a very, very hot flashpoint in the Asia-Pacific region overall. China, as everybody knows, is rising, and China claims a large swath of the South China Sea. A massive, massive area of water is claimed by China with its historical nine-dash line claim. And in recent months, China has been intensifying its activities in the region, undertaking what we are calling land reclamation activities, which is basically that it is turning these installations, these reefs, coral reefs and other features, including small islands, into larger islands, into broader facilities, building airstrips, building naval facilities, all sorts of things. And the explanation that China has provided is that all of this is for benign intents and purposes, for maritime research, for hydrography and other purposes. But there are concerns in the region that these could be used for military purposes. And overall, going back to the issue of the disputes, is the concern that China is changing facts on the water by carrying out these land reclamation activities. China is improving its claim to these territories. So let me just lay out how we're going to do this podcast. First, we'll talk a bit about what China is doing, and I'll maybe turn it over to Shannon to kind of give us an update on these land reclamation activities. And then we'll talk a bit about China's nine-dash line claim and what that actually means. Since it's a little bit more complicated than just a complete claim to the waters within the South China Sea, it actually represents China's maximum claims in the area. And after that, we'll leverage Prashant's knowledge of the region and go around and do a tour of Southeast Asia and discuss how the other claimant states are approaching China and are approaching the dispute. All right, so Shannon, like I said, would you mind walking us through a bit about what China is up to in the South China Sea with this land reclamation activities? I know I talked about it a little bit, but it'd be great if you could kind of take us in with a little more detail.
Sure. So basically what China is doing, at least in Chinese eyes, is playing catch up. Because they weren't involved in the kind of the rush for the land masses in the 70s and 80s, they kind of missed out. And they actually occupy less of these shoals than the other claimants, the other main claimants, at least Vietnam and the Philippines. So China is trying to basically do as much as they can with the islands that they do occupy. And because they weren't able to occupy any islands that were big enough naturally to build things on, because, again, they were late to this game, they are basically taking the islands that they have and making them big enough to build on. So the things of most concern for observers are the fact that China appears to be building airstrips at Fiery Cross Reef and Subi Reef. And people are worried that this may be predecessor for China actually declaring an air defense identification zone over the South China Sea to go with the ADIZ that they declared in late 2013 over the East China Sea. And that would be very problematic for freedom of navigation in the region and, for China exerting de facto control over the airspace over the South China Sea.
Mm-hmm. I think the Chinese perception of their own activities is pretty interesting. I mean, today you just I remember earlier you told me that was it a Chinese official who had said that China was essentially I'm trying to remember what the quote was. It was about, China being a large state and therefore the activities that it was pursuing and the pace at which it was pursuing them in the South China Sea were commensurate with its size and its capabilities. Mm-hmm. So there's definitely this a perception within China that they are playing catch up. And it's true to an extent, but if you look at the pace at which these activities are proceeding, it's turning into it's completely shifting the landscape. I mean, obviously there's serious environmental concerns as well.
Right.
This sort of development can completely damage the fragile ecosystem in the area. It's very problematic. You brought up the issue of the ADIZ, and I wonder, Shannon, one of the theories that I kind of personally had was that the reason we haven't seen a South China Sea ADIZ is because the nine-dash line isn't actually a declaration of China's, own perception of its territorial claim. I think I've read that it's more a declaration of what China sees as its maximum possible claim in the region, and the reason it's pursuing these reclamation activities is to actually operate within the confines of UNCLOS, the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea, and build these facilities up to have access to that 200 nautical mile exclusive economic zone that other states claim as well. So do you think that that's accurate, or is the nine-dash line more similar to what China claims in the East China Sea, for example, where there are no dashes, it's just simply a line that China draws and claims as its territorial waters?
I think what you see right now is China trying to reconcile this pre-existing historical claim, which was actually not originated by the PRC government, but with Chiang Kai-shek's ROC government in 1947, with existing international law, which of course came after China had already drawn this dashed line. Mm-hmm. So what they're trying to do is find a way to keep their nine dash line claim without being found blatantly in violation of UNCLOS, which is very difficult to do. And I think
so
that's
basically
why
what China is trying
China
to do is take this claim from the 1940s
in great detail
and bring
exactly
it into
what
compliance
their claims
with
are.
Modern day international law as we understand it. And that's a difficult task, but they're trying, and that's really why they haven't put out a specific, clear legal definition of the extent of their claims, because I think they're still trying to work it out themselves. So the thought is that China is going to try and use these islands to generate an EEZ that will more or less approximate the extent of the nine dash line without China having to say, we are just claiming these waters within the line. They can point to, we control this reef, it generates an EEZ out to here. The question, of course, is whether all of these reefs and shoals, at some of which are even below sea level at times, are actually capable of generating an EEZ under UNCLOS. And that's one theory for why China is doing this massive land reclamation and why the timing of it started right as the Philippines filed its own case for arbitration, saying that China's nine-dash line is invalid. One theory is that China's essentially rushing to change the facts on the ground before the international tribunal has a chance to tell China it can't do that.
Right.
Another theory, and I think this is more applicable to the ADIZ, is that China is in effect retaliating for what it sees as the Philippines' bad behavior. So if the Philippines is going to file a case against us, which we've said multiple times we do not recognize and will not participate in, well, fine, then we're going to do massive land reclamations in the South China Sea. And so there's also a sense that China is kind of sitting on establishing an ADIZ over the South China Sea until it has some reasonable way of saying it was provoked into doing so. So if Vietnam or the Philippines or another actor starts making what China sees provoked moves in the South China Sea, it might go ahead and declare an ADIZ and justify it that way, which was interesting. The foreign ministry today actually said that China would retain the right to declare an ADIZ. It would depend on whether air safety was threatened, which to me is a clear sign that China is waiting for something. They don't want to just declare this ADIZ out of nowhere. They kind of want to have some semi-legitimate, at least, reason for doing it.
Mm-hmm. I guess patrols, either from ASEAN or Japan, would be a pretty good excuse. So this topic that you're talking about China trying to create an exclusive economic zone for itself, on Monday I was at this conference hosted by the Journal on Political Risk, and Gregory Poling from CSIS spoke there, and he actually had a great presentation in which he included a map. So he actually did the calculations, giving China a very charitable interpretation of what features it can claim. So assuming that China actually manages to successfully put a claim through UNCLOS to every land feature within the nine-dash line, the EEZ that would be generated, the 200 nautical mile EEZ, does not even come close to the actual width of the nine-dash line. I mean, that means I think it leaves out some features like the James Shoal and the Natuna waters that Indonesia and Malaysia are convinced about, worried about. But it's definitely an interesting topic because, the nine-dash line as it is portrayed and as it is understood by a lot of people is definitely not something that China can ever really have under UNCLOS if it wants to be even perceived as complying with international law in any way. And I was glad that you brought up the issue of the Philippines case. We'll actually get to that later in the podcast. But now I want to move over a bit and you know, let Prashant kind of have his voice. He's been the silent observer so far, but now he'll be talking a lot more, hopefully. So Prashant, can you just walk us through, since this is a South China Sea update, I just kind of want to get a sense of, you know, where every Southeast Asian claimant state is vis-a-vis its disputes with China. All these states have different approaches. They're investing in different forms of military and political assets to counter China in the South China Sea. So I guess let's start with Vietnam, and then we'll go counterclockwise around the region geographically around the South China Sea. So Vietnam, I think it's almost next week will mark a year since China moved an oil rig into Vietnam's exclusive economic zone, sparking a major crisis between the two countries. Can you tell us about where the two countries are now, Prashant?
Yeah, I mean, I think for most of these claimants, I would say it's in the past year, and even the last couple of months, and then ASEAN as a whole, it's sort of been more of the same, I would say. So they've all pursued a combination of, you know, diplomatic, legal, and then some security and military initiatives. So Vietnam and the Philippines, that would be useful points to start because they're the sort of the frontline states in the South China Sea. And Vietnam is sort of a little bit of an outlier because there you're dealing with the Paracels instead of the Spratly Islands. Mm-hmm. With the rest of the claimants, you're dealing with the Spratly Islands. And actually, if you go back to how the South China Sea was dealt, there was actually a division about, you know, between the Spratly Islands and the Paracel Islands. So Vietnam has been continuing its policy. So in terms of the military initiatives, the Vietnamese continue to invest in different military technologies that will give them significant maritime capabilities to safeguard their claims against the Chinese. In terms of the legal realm, the Vietnamese haven't directly supported the Philippine case against China, but they have been sort of, they've sent supporting arguments. So they haven't formally been in the case with the Philippines, which they've been very careful to avoid. But they also want to send a signal to the Chinese that they're also worried about the situation. So they're walking a very fine line between that. And so Vietnam and then together with the Philippines, both of them have also been trying to get ASEAN to move in a more aggressive way to counter the Chinese and their actions in the South China Sea. But, you know, so far that's been, I would say it's always a mixed bag with ASEAN, but the recent 26th ASEAN summit that was concluded last month, you saw one of the strongest statements on the South China Sea. But, you know, as many other observers noted, even that very strong statement didn't mention China by name. So it's always a mixed bag when you talk about ASEAN and the regional approach. So.
Right. You know, there's the people talk about the north-south split between ASEAN and how they view China. Obviously, the continental states are more interested in having their economic relations in China not be derailed by the South China Sea dispute. But speaking of South ASEAN, let's go down a bit and talk a bit about Malaysia, Indonesia, and Brunei. Indonesia isn't actually a claimant, but it is starting to get more involved in the South China Sea disputes with its concerns over the Natuna waters. But can you tell us a bit about these three states?
Sure, absolutely. Yeah, so with the Philippines, that's the other, as I said, frontline state on the South China Sea. And the Filipinos have recently been in a lot of run-ins with the Chinese in the sea as well as in the air. And there's going to be a lot of activity. There's actually is a lot of ongoing activity between the Philippines and the United States, but also the Philippines and Japan. So next week, the Philippines and Japan are scheduled to hold their first exercise in the South China Sea. And this follows significant strengthening of the security part of the relationship between the Philippines and Japan. And this is coming on the back of conversations about joint U.S. and Japanese patrols in the South China Sea. This is coming on the back of talk of a formalized strategic partnership between Vietnam and the Philippines. So the Filipinos are involved in a big way. And before the ASEAN summit, the Filipinos were very outspoken about the fact that, you know, we're going to go to the summit and raise very publicly the issue of China's land reclamation activities. And we really want to see the organization take a forward-leaning position on this because, you know, the question that they raise is, I mean, what more does China have to do for us to take a strong position on this? And they were, you know, I think President Aquino after the summit said that they were somewhat satisfied with ASEAN's statement and the unity that they had achieved. But obviously, you know, there's always more that ASEAN can do from the perspective of the Vietnamese and the Filipinos. If you look at Malaysia, Malaysia is in an interesting position this year because they're the chair of ASEAN. And the Malaysians traditionally have been, you know, Malaysia's approach to the South China Sea, the Chinese actually have characterized it as a quiet approach, and one which they prefer compared to the Vietnamese and the Filipinos. But Malaysia, even Malaysia has been extremely cautious in the last 1 or 2 years in terms of how they're dealing with the Chinese. I think they recognize that with some of the things that Shannon was talking about earlier, like, you know, increased land reclamation activities, the kind of infrastructure that the Chinese are building there, potentially an airstrip, and then also other sort of just the extent of the reach of China is going to bring it in increasing contact with the Malaysians. And so Malaysia recognizes that, you know, increasingly this is going to become a concern. So they have worked to increase their military capabilities. They have also ensured that the South China Sea issue gets a fair hearing within ASEAN, which is, I think, important for Malaysia because Malaysia sees itself as one of the founding members of ASEAN. And this year is the advent of the ASEAN community at the end of the year. And so Malaysia wants to ensure that there's as much unity as possible within the grouping. So yeah, those are the two main. And I would say, you know, Brunei remains pretty quiet on the South China Sea. Malaysia and Brunei a few years ago made a very quiet agreement to resolve some of their conflicting claims, because I think one of the important points to make is, you know, this isn't just an issue between China and ASEAN states. I mean, these Southeast Asian states also have disagreements between themselves. And so Malaysia and a number of other countries have been quietly and also increasingly publicly saying that we need to resolve our differences between ourselves as well. And that will give us a more unified position to then talk to the Chinese about a code of conduct in the South China Sea and so on and so forth. With the Indonesians, as you correctly pointed out, they don't consider themselves technically a claimant to the South China Sea disputes. And that's very intentional because the Indonesians think that if they view themselves as a claimant, that essentially is endorsing the extent of Chinese claims that would, as you say, infringe on the Natuna Islands, which are very resource-rich islands. And so there's sort of a lack of clarity between the Chinese and the Indonesians as to whether, you know, is China going to make a future claim to these things? The Indonesians have sought many, many clarifications over the years from the Chinese, and they've gotten some reinsurances, but it's not been entirely satisfactory. So the Indonesians, likewise, they've taken a variety of approaches. So they submitted, a protest. They filed a protest to the UN in, you know, a few years ago. They've also increased their military capabilities, particularly their naval capabilities. Jokowi's been talking about this global maritime fulcrum. And part of that, I mean, obviously there are many components to what that involves. There's an economic component. There's a general naval component. There's so many threats, but I would say part of it is definitely to enable Indonesia to safeguard its territorial integrity and its sovereignty. And part of that would definitely include the Natuna Islands and the South China Sea. Now, at the same time, I think it's important to point out that all of these countries, so even the Vietnam, the Philippines, you know, Malaysia, Indonesia, are still involved extensively with the Chinese in other dimensions of their relationship. Even the Philippines, you know, being the host of APEC this year, was one of the first countries to sign on to the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank that was, you know, China-backed. And there's very much a feeling that for many of these Southeast Asian countries, China is an extremely important, sometimes the most important economic partner. And so it's very important to keep the momentum going in terms of the general relationship with China, but at the same time, point out that what it's doing in the South China Sea may infringe on their interests. And that's a very careful balance that all of these countries need to walk.
thanks a lot, Prashant. That was very, very detailed, informative. Thanks for taking us around the South China Sea, basically. I mean, the claimant we didn't really talk about is Taiwan. Is there anything that you want to add about Taiwan specifically? I mean, it is a claimant in the South China Sea, but obviously there's a whole can of worms when you're discussing China and Taiwan.
Yeah, I mean, I think the layman's version is sort of, Taiwan's claims are essentially the same as China's claims. And I think, there's a little bit more nuance to that, and some would say more than a little nuance to that, because the Taiwanese have actually, over the past year or so, they've been actually adjusting what they mean by their claims and, how that affects how they deal with these kinds of disputes. So they have spoken about the South China Sea in terms of how they've spoken increasingly about the East China Sea. They have an East China Sea Peace Initiative, and they've sort of extended that a little bit into how they're talking about territorial disputes in general, which is to say that, their country should set aside some of these disputes that they have and focus on joint development, et cetera, et cetera. There have been informal reports and all kinds of rumors about how Taiwan's position and policy may change after the upcoming elections. Depending on who wins, I mean, we won't see, I don't think, a radical or drastic shift in Taiwan's South China Sea policy. But I do think it's important to keep in mind that we can't just view the Taiwan South China Sea policy as, totally similar to what the Chinese are doing, because I think increasingly there are conversations not just within Taiwan, but among Taiwan's partners and friends, including the United States, about how Taiwan might contribute to this increasingly tense situation in the South China Sea. And I think the Taiwanese, I don't think have made up their mind firmly about where they want to be in terms of relative to China and some of their other positions. So.
Great. Thanks a lot, Prashant, again. Now let's talk a bit about this case that's pending at The Hague at the Permanent Court of Arbitration between Philippines and China over the South China Sea dispute. Now, the Philippines has submitted 4,000 pages, I believe, in support of its claims, and China has yet to submit anything. And at the same time, as Shannon said, in order to boost its standing before the court and in the eyes of international law, China is carrying out these land reclamation activities. So we're expecting oral arguments in July and a decision either at the end of this year or early next year, depending on how things turn out. I imagine that the court will probably rule this in the favor of the Philippines if China does not submit anything, which it doesn't appear to be doing anytime soon. The question I have for both of you is, what will the fallout of this be? I guess, Shannon, it would be great if you could speak to what the fallout would be for China, and Prashant, I guess, for the broader impact that would have on how the other South China Sea littoral states view their claims and disputes with China. So I guess, Shannon, let's pass it over to you since Prashant was talking for a while.
China has very consistently said it does not recognize this as a valid case, which is why it's not participating in it. When China signed UNCLOS, it specifically said that it opted out of being forced to go to court to defend its claims, and it's now kind of justifying itself by that. China's main argument also, which it submitted in an open position paper, so not a formal submission to the court, but clearly they wanted the tribunal to take notice of it, was that the tribunal does not have jurisdiction to settle this issue. Now, China's main argument is that the South China Sea issue can only be solved by solving the basic territorial claims, and that all of the claims to maritime resources, for example, cannot be addressed until the central territorial issues are solved. So they're saying that the tribunal cannot adjudicate China's nine-dash line and how it may or may not conflict with other countries' claims until the issue of who owns what islands is solved, which, of course, may never happen. So China's effectively saying there's no arbitration until the territorial disputes are done. And they have set themselves up to basically ignore any ruling from the tribunal because they've consistently said, we don't recognize this case, we're not participating in this case, the tribunal does not have jurisdiction on this case. Now, that being said, I think it's telling that China has started so frantically building up these islands before the tribunal lays down its decision. I think it's indicative that China wants to try and get as much of this done before the tribunal actually lays down its ruling. So what we might see is China do some sort of token nod to the ruling to show, yes, we do respect international law, you know, by say maybe stopping the construction. But by that point, the construction will have already been done. What we're not going to see is China withdraw from these areas. We're not going to see China stop patrolling these areas. You know, whether China does something provocative, like putting another oil rig inside another country's claim to easy, we'll have to wait and see. And again, I think that will be really determined by what China views other countries as doing. If China views other countries as being provocative, then they're going to want to kind of jump on that and say, well, now we can do this because they did that. But it will be interesting. I think it will depend on what the international community does in recognition of this judgment. And that's really the million-dollar question, because as Prashant was saying, countries don't want to alienate China. They still want to have economic trade with China. They want to have a good relationship with China. So how far can you go in saying, look, this international tribunal laid down this rule and we need to respect it? How much pressure can you really put on China to abide by that? And that's the question that all of these regional governments are going to have to try to answer.
Yeah, and the United States isn't really in a place to lecture, considering that it hasn't ratified UNCLOS itself. thanks a lot, Shannon. Prashant, can you fill us in on the flip side? What would the effect be for the states that you just discussed a few minutes ago?
Yeah, I mean, I think I'd agree with Shannon. I mean, the tribunal, you know, can decide a range of ways. So, you know, they could decide the case, you know, entirely against China. They could just sort of fudge it a little bit and say that, you know, the Philippines is right on these particular issues, but on other issues, they're not, they don't have the right claim, or these features are, the case is not clear on these features, et cetera, et cetera. So I think it's very complicated how this decision is going to turn out. But I think one important consequence that we will have is, I mean, this is a landmark international judgment, and countries have increasingly been coalescing around this idea of, including the United States, we don't want to support claims of individual countries, but we want to make sure that a rule of law approach is preserved in the South China Sea and the Asia Pacific, and we want to ensure peace and stability. Well, this kind of decision, no matter how it goes, it gives the United States and other actors in the international community a way to say, well, we're not really taking sides because this was a decision that was taken by the tribunal, and so we're merely supporting what could be seen as international law. Now, it remains to be seen how exactly these countries' positions will evolve, because if you look at U.S. South China Sea policy, for all the significant things that the Chinese have done, I mean, there's still very influential voices in Washington who point out the fact that the very simple question, I guess I pose it very simply, is, you know, how much is the South China Sea an interest to U.S. policy? Is it really a vital interest? And how much should we be emphasizing this relative to the overall U.S.-China relationship and relative to our overall U.S.-Asia policy? So even if you get a landmark international decision, I'm not sure how much U.S. policy is going to be adjusted. I mean, the U.S. has taken significant measures over the last 4 or 5 years. Going back to what Hillary Clinton said in 2010, their support for the Philippine case, extensive military capabilities given to several Southeast Asian countries in order to support themselves. But some of the more far-reaching military measures that the United States would have to take, and I'm talking beyond, you know, military exercises with Southeast Asian countries, and so on and so forth, and indirect support, and, you know, the fact that the U.S. is going to increase the presence of its ships. I'm not sure how much appetite there is and how much consensus there is for those more forward-leaning measures. I tend to think that there's some division on that, and I actually think that that is going to be the more interesting to watch. I mean, how much does this decision that people have been talking about for a year plus going to really change the conditions on the ground? Because as Shannon pointed out, the Chinese have ignored the tribunal. They've said they don't want to participate. And they've been busy making their own case, not participating, but making their own case so that their voice is heard, but they don't participate in a process that they view as illegitimate, which is extremely smart from their perspective. So even if this decision is made, you know, you may see China slow down its activities, but you know, as Shannon correctly said, they've already done so much. I mean, if you look at the figures of the Radical Reformation activities, so the United States estimates, last year the Chinese, I think the estimates were 500 acres. This year alone, up to May, we're now in May, it's 2,000 acres that the Chinese have done. I mean, that is extremely significant. And some of these are they're made up islands, and you know several Southeast Asian countries have engaged in land reclamation activities before, but not nearly on this scale, and not nearly with that kind of intensity, and some of the conflicts or near conflicts that we've seen. So it's really interesting to see how this case is going to play out, because you know you could make the argument, a very reasonable argument, that despite the significance of it in the international legal dimension, not a lot may change on the ground in actual fact, just because the actors may be doing a lot of things on several dimensions beyond the legal realm, and those may matter more, and the legal dimension may just support some of these additional measures that they want to take. So whether it's rhetorical statements by the United States and the international community, or whether it's Vietnam and the Philippines being able to say, hey, listen, ASEAN, you know, this is not just about the two of us anymore. It's an international law issue. So ASEAN should take a stronger position because this is about the rule of law. So I think that's sort of the adjustments you may have to watch. And the other more far-reaching things, I'd be really interested to see whether they actually happen.
Thanks a lot, Prashant. That's very interesting. Obviously, this is a very complex issue. I mean, if we're voting, I think my vote is right there with the both of you, that I don't think that this will actually end up changing too much on the water in the South China Sea. China is, in fact, changing the most, as Prashant just reminded us. Thank you both for joining me and for providing your perspectives. I always appreciate your expertise on these issues. Thanks, Prashant, and thanks, Shannon.
Sure. Thanks a lot.
Yeah.
Thanks, Ankit.
And for those of you listening, always leave us a review on iTunes suggesting improvements or topics for future episodes. I'm always happy to engage on that issue. And keep an eye on The Diplomat, where we will regularly be featuring more pieces and analysis on the South China Sea, particularly as the year continues and as we think about this a case between the Philippines and China and China's broader activities in the region. Thank you for listening.